Hello, and welcome to Landward, Readings of Place and Season. I'm Catherine Young. I live, farm, and write in Richland County in the Driftless area of Wisconsin. Today I have an unusual story of place told in two voices, one of poetry and the other prose. It is, "In That River, I Saw Him Again." It begins this way.
As seen from the window of a speeding locomotive, the world is a blur like a fast-moving river. Up close, a train passes like a flickering shadow. Looking into the distance, rails converge, then vanish. What can the heart remember?
Endless streams of coal trains coursed in and out of my childhood in Pennsylvania's Lackawanna Valley, the largest coal mining valley in the world. A century before I was born, anthracite coal and iron from our ground was extracted to make the steel rails that crossed the nation, that sent coal-fueled locomotives up and out, carrying coal to industry everywhere. It spilled black diamonds lining every rail, road, and byway. Trains ran over and over like an endless loop of film.
Over and over, running like a loop of film.
Trains and film have an intertwined history. In River of Shadows, Rebecca Solnit writes of Edward Muybridge, whose photography experiments led to cinema. Muybridge worked for Leland Stanford, the 19th century multimillionaire railroad baron, owner of the Central Pacific. Stanford employed Muybridge to photograph the West to draw tourists, and he provided Muybridge with a mechanical engineer from the railroad who could design a timed sequence of cameras around a racetrack from Muybridge's experiments with motion pictures. Success came in 1872 when Muybridge produced a series of photos, almost silhouettes, of horse and rider that, when slipped into a candlelit zoopraxiscope, became moving pictures, the first cinema. Solnit writes, "It was as though he had grasped time itself, made it stand still, and then made it run over and over again."
Trains pass like shadows.
Half a century beyond my childhood in a new millennium, I miss the passing coal trains, the people I loved. They exist for me in shadowy images of memory and in old photographs where they are brought to life.
Images emerge.
In 1839, when Louis Daguerre produced what is now believed to be the first photograph, he said, "I have seized the light. I have arrested its flight." The exposure took 7 minutes, and it captured the still objects, buildings and streets in Paris, and the objects in motion, a shoeshine boy and people and carriages in motion, are smudges and shadows too blurry to discern. The living, breathing, moving beings are mostly invisible.
Images converge.
"Here, come see," the women in my family said to me when I was a child. "Here are pictures of your people. Look at the pictures so you can remember them," they'd command. And I looked at the images of people from before my time, posed outdoors against rose bushes as they faced the sun for the best lighting, and their world rimmed in soot of locomotives. My family's photo collection showed the progression of photography. Sepia images from the late 1800s captured great-grandparents posed in formal clothes. These echo the miniature sepia studio portraits that were still found on cemetery headstones in my childhood, encased in disintegrating yellowed cellophane. The small yellowed photos from the 19-teens showed my dad and his cousins posing in their sailor suits in backyards for amateur family photographers. There are hardly any family photos from the Great Depression era, when getting enough to eat was the most important and all-consuming task. Photos reappeared as black and white portraits of family members in World War II uniforms, commemorations of enlistees who might never return. By the time of the 1950s, our photos were high gloss, black and white, bound into thematic booklets of everyday life in the yards and on the Little League field. Indoor flash photos documented each birthday, church sacrament, and holiday. "Remember?" the women would say to me, holding a photograph. Do you remember this person? When the weight of the question bore down, the imperative changed. Look at this photo. Remember, they commanded. And in the shadow of their command, the words echoed, Your people left so many of their people behind in Europe before the 20th century. These photographs are for you and your children in the next century. And then their stories would pause, a shutter of film at the end of a reel, the bright lights flicked on too quickly, a blankness on the screen as they spoke the present. How I wish I could see him again, her again. I wished then to caress the sepia faces, pull them from the shadows, as over and over the words from my elders dropped like beads unstrung. How I wish.
In the river of time, what does the heart remember?
I felt that way about my dad. All I had to remember him by were photos. When my dad died, I was 8 years old. I was there beside him as he sat down in a chair, began to shudder and sweat, as the light in his eyes went into shadow, as his brain flooded with blood and shut off all his senses. And then he was gone. I looked at photos with longing, wishing I could make him reappear. After his death, I stayed at the house of my dad's brother, Uncle Bill, a railroad engineer, the guardian assigned to me at birth, a man whose laughter bubbled out of him like water from a deep and powerful spring. He made me feel all was well in the world. I was in awe of Uncle Bill, the engineer, and each time I saw a Lackawanna Railroad locomotive passing by, I looked for him.
Trains pass.
Voices swirl in my memories. Look, there's a train coming up our hollow. Come on out onto the porch. Look, maybe it's Uncle Bill in the cab of that switching engine. There, he's blowing the horn. He sees you. I grew up in a house, a neighborhood, a city with trains running over, around, down, and through.
Like an endless loop of film.
Lassoed by trains, a necklace of rail cars like a choker. I couldn't go anywhere without crossing tracks. Even when I graduated my neighborhood school and began junior high school in the valley, we had to cross a main line at lunchtime. Look, we all sat on the other side of the tracks as we heard the sound of the tritone triad horn echoing off the brick factory buildings. Bad timing. There go the crossing guards. That train is coming full speed upgrade. Four locomotives in front. You going to cross? You gotta cross. You only have 5 minutes to run up that hill and then get to the third floor of that junior high. You'll be late for science.
Memories race.
I searched my memories of being with my dad, but they're few. He was a firefighter who worked a strange rotating schedule, living and sleeping away from home for days. At home, he slept while we were awake. Imprinted inside me is one of the last photos taken of my dad, Ben. He's in his black T-shirt in our grassy mountain yard, terraced into the dumped tailings of steel rail smelting, a backyard built upon 19th century ashes. In the photo, he stands beside the rock wall separating the next yard uphill from ours, the yard much taller than he. Every spring, as land pushed downward, he struggled to put the immense black rocks back in place. It was rare to see a photo of my dad looking into the camera, but in this one, he looks directly to some unknown future.
Images vanish.
Sometimes I wonder, what does a photograph capture? How can it capture anything at all? Is it a snare? In my high school years, cameras aimed at me were snares on a trap line. I felt snagged, tagged. In my teens, I knew I no longer wanted to be frozen into photos. I didn't want my picture to be pointed at in parlors for posterity. I couldn't imagine having posterity or wanting it. My adult brother photographed trains. He raced by car along back roads, along circuitous byways to catch the straight-lining diesel locomotives with their cars in tow, grinding against gravity. He photographed them as if they were beasts, and the camera gave a rare opportunity to capture them in the wild. Trains were an endangered species. We did not want to admit this. It would have meant that we, the Valley of Coal, the Valley of Railroads, would have no reason to appear on any map because all of it would vanish.
Shadows flicker.
Railroads made cinema possible. Solnit writes, It was the first time photographs had dissected and reanimated actual motion. It was the foundation of cinema. and motion pictures changed the relationship to time farther. They made it possible to step in the same river twice, to see not just the images, but events that have happened in other times and other places, almost to stop living where you were and start living in other places or other times.
Shadows converge into that river.
When I was a child, the only movies available to us were in theaters. No one I knew had a motion camera, a Super 8 to make films of family, until I was in high school visiting faraway cousins and was upended by a few moments of a motion picture in which my dad reappeared, a film I never knew existed. In the silent flickering colors on the basement rec room screen, all of my maternal cousins and I flash past the camera in our swimsuits, jumping, flinging ourselves through space, slipping down a yellow plastic water slide as we rode the slippery track, each of our smiles as wide as the horizon. All at once, the scene moved upward to my parents standing in the background, their gestures caught on film. I watched, frozen, as the film moved on. In a flash, my view of reality changed. My dad had been a real person. He had died. My father was not just an image in black and white. He was a man in a black t-shirt standing in a world of summer green with children's joyous shrieks moving through his thoughts. He stood with his arm around my mama's shoulder as she, smiling, folded her arms across her middle, her shy gesture against being seen. Caught by the camera for just those few seconds through the silent colors, Ben was, for me, alive again as he turned his head.
What can the heart remember?
To remember is to come into the mind again as previously perceived, known, or felt, to have renewed apprehension of, to put back the limbs and make whole, to think of again, to recollect, recollect. I remember when my dad passed, I spent a lot of time with my cousin. My cousin was the brother I chased after. 5 months apart in age, my cousin and I were practically litter mates. We shared the same neighborhood, a hollow at the base of a mountain, traversed by rails, dirt roads, and a creek. We shared the same decrepit, deteriorating neighborhood pool. We shared all the same stories. I would have followed him anywhere. My cousin's inner world was different from mine. While I played fairy child and princess needing to be rescued, my cousin was forever fighting an unseen foe. When the woods were removed from the lot next to his house and all the bedrock smashed to shattered slate, my cousin belly crawled over the shards up to the rim, with me crawling close behind. In his imagination, he was immersed in a world war like my dad fought in, the one his dad was too young to enlist in. We both knew World War II through photos, 8x10 portraits of my dad, Ben, and his next younger brother, Bob, in dress uniform. The photos, unusual by their size in our family collection, were a focal point in our grandma's house. They showed both men, muscular and clean-shaven, their eyes pale in the tones of black and white, their smiles broad. Surely, that was before they went to battle, before they returned home with the light in their eyes dimmed, before beers at the tavern to forget. It was long before anyone knew that they were both slow-dying casualties of a world war that they would pass when my cousin and I were children. But no one could predict that my cousin's dad, my locomotive-driving uncle, would be gone before his son finished high school. No one talked openly about cancer then. We just watched, feeling helpless as he became weaker, spending more and more time in the hospital where my cousin and I were born, where I worked as a candy striper. I knew all the halls, the rooms. I knew it as a place where people came to die. When that time came for my uncle, he asked for me. All his bubbling laughter had drained away. He lay skeletal in a hospital bed, holding my hands, telling me he didn't want to die. He begged me to please, please hold him. After my uncle passed, my cousin and I didn't see each other for many years.
Trains pass.
I asked my brother once what exactly a railroad engineer does. He told me that the engineer has his hand on the throttle, reads the signals, and keeps the foot on the dead man pedal, the pedal required to keep the train running, the release of which would stop the train. Dead man pedal. How many men now gone, I wonder, kept the foot on the pedal, kept the trains in motion, hauling coal, 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 and freight.
The heart races.
In the family I create, I scramble to take photos with print film documenting the birthdays and life-changing events of my own children, carefully pasting the printed photos into large sketchbooks, writing stories in the margins. But then technology moves on. Photo film becomes scarce and there's no one to print it. I succumb to looking at digital photos on screens. Still, it brings stories. Stories I didn't know were in me arise, and I remember. I put things back into place from when they were shifted in the motion of the world. I wonder sometimes, is telling stories like stringing coal cars together? Or is it more like looking into a river of shadows that I can never again see clearly what was? All at once, I want to see the place I knew as a child in color and in motion, because it is so much gone. I want to see the trains of my childhood again and the power of their movement. I trawl the internet, trying out the names of the railroads from my valley, one after the other, searching for trains from the 1950s and 60s. I search YouTube for the Lackawanna Railroad, the one my engineer uncle Bill worked for, and I find one. The video is posted as Lackawanna Freight 1958. A good find, the year of my birth. The color film has no sound. It begins with a scene at a station. An older engineer in overalls, striped cap, and black kit bag climbs up into one of the awaiting gray and maroon striped diesel locomotives. A few moments later, a younger man, similarly dressed, obviously the older man's son, climbs aboard. The spliced film alternates passing coal and freight trains in the mountains with scenes from inside the cab. The journey shows the land that I knew as a child, the blue rounded mountains in the background, the dark ground of coal along the silver tracks bordered by russeted trees. Scene after silent scene, the film progresses to give an engineer's point of view. At about 10 minutes into the 13-minute video, a viaduct, an arched span, appears ahead on the straightway. Banks of familiar black stones and beds of spilled coal line the tracks. When the camera shifts back to the cab, there's a smiling engineer at the throttle, but he's not the older man nor his son. His hair and eyes are dark. He turns slightly and nods. What a beautiful face. And there's something about it. I go back and watch it again. 3 seconds of the man in profile. He nods, a shutter of film, then 2 more seconds, and then he's gone. He doesn't appear again in the video. There's something familiar about that face. He actually looks a little like my brother when he was younger. He looks... By now, I feel the tightening in my chest. After 60 years, could it be Uncle Bill?
The world blurs. What can the heart remember that the fast-moving mind cannot?
I pull my box of photos from the upstairs closet. I find the envelope holding the remaining black and white frill-edged square childhood photos torn from their booklets. Me as a baby in my dad's arms standing out in front of the house, my dad shirtless in the summer heat of 1958. And then a picture from my family's parlor, a dark-haired man in a light-colored suit holding a baby in a lacy christening gown. The day he promised to be my guardian. Uncle Bill, smiling down at me, and I, the newborn, must be staring at that face.
As seen from the window of a speeding locomotive, the world is a fast-moving river.
I watch the film again. Surely the scenes outside the locomotive are October. The ribboned maroon and gold pattern painted on the gray locomotive echo the russeted trees. It must be October 1958, the month my cousin turned one. I would have been 6 months old. Both of us were surely carried in the heart of Bill, the engineer, newly married, in love with his work and young family, speeding through the river valleys lined with coal.
Memories emerge.
I hesitate a moment before dialing my cousin's long-distance phone number. The grief over his mother's recent death is raw. Cuz, I say to him on the phone, I was looking at some railroad videos online. I pause, then say, I think I saw your dad. I'll send you the link. Is that okay? I wait for him to look. I tell him, try 10 minutes and 12 seconds. It's only a few seconds long, I say, reaching into the silence that follows. Before I can ask him what he thinks, my cousin speaks from experience as a detective. But that man was not at the beginning or end. It looks like those seconds around 10-12 were spliced in. Then there's quiet on the line, and when he speaks, there's resignation in his voice. I think it's him. He was always smiling, my cousin tells me. He loved his job. He loved his life. As if our thoughts trail along parallel rails, I can almost hear him thinking how his mom would have wanted to see this video, and then he says, there's probably no one we can ask. Cuz, I say to him, maybe my brother would know. I'll call him. Let's see if he agrees. I'll call you back. The answer comes within minutes. Sis, my brother says, strange you should ask. I just watched that video 2 weeks ago. I thought it was Bill. Yes, of course, I think. Uncle Bill would smile. His son just a year old, the world swirling by, home soon.
Rails converge.
Here is a line. In River of Shadows, Rebecca Solnit draws it, and I connect the dots. The line runs from coal to trains and rails to produce photos to cinema where motion is recorded for all time.
Shadows flicker.
I'm afraid to look at the video again, but I do. It's a kind of voyeurism, isn't it? But it's only an impression in light and dark. With a click on the computer, I could choose to see that impression of my uncle again and again. And still, his hand is on the throttle. The October landscape blurs behind him in the window frame. He turns and smiles, then turns away again. Though the film is silent, I swear I know what's said. Hey, Bill, the men say. We'll film you for posterity. In profile, Bill makes a skeptical slight nod of his head. Like in Daguerre's Paris, behind him, all is a blur of motion.
From the window of a speeding locomotive, the world is like a fast-moving river.
Bill, I can hear them say, come on, smile for the camera. Someday, you'll be famous. You can show your son. He turns toward the camera only for an instant, a steady smile. Not for the ones holding the camera, nor for some imagined viewer in the future. It's a smile just for being alive with his hand on the throttle.
Up close, a train passes like a flickering shadow.
He turns. He smiles just for living as he speeds through time.
Rails converge, then vanish into the distance.
You have been listening to In That River I Saw Him Again, my creative nonfiction piece published in Hippocampus in 2018, and it was a semi-finalist for their nonfiction contest. Many thanks to my friend Julie Caspers-Egger, who voiced the lines of the poem. You can find more of my writing at katherineyoungwriter.com. This is Katherine Young for Landward. Thanks for listening. Podcasts of this recording will be available at wdrt.org.